American media is a business, and it has a mission. Not to inform Americans, but to entertain them.
You know, there's happy news for happy people with happy problems.
And the business leaders said that they had to renew with vigor what they called the everlasting battle for the minds of men and indoctrinate citizens with a capitalist story.
Global corporations feeding us the news as they see fit.
Truth is subversive, it's anti-American.
Americans have computers in school, dozens of TV stations, and the most aggressive news media on Earth. Does that mean they're better informed? Hardly.
And it is a good day. This is Ryan Robson reporting to you from Youthnet for Monday, August 15th, 2011. You are listening to Newsreel, the WOG Global sit-rep on core political tyranny, technology, and trends for your headspace and timing. Rant Media is taking a stand for free speech today, and just by listening and distributing this program, you are too. Also standing up for free speech and joining me today is Misanthropic Gods.
And follow these news stories and check our facts by going to the Rant Media forum and looking under Newsreel for a post with today's date. You get there by going to smf.rantradio.com. This would be a free podcast. It can be heard on Rant Radio Talk, Galaxy 15 Radio, and recorded live in Second Life every Thursday night at 7 p.m. SL time. Hit grid archers 155-74666. What we need most of all right now is your support. If you have something to send us, please email us at news@rostudios.org. That is news@rostudios.org. Joining us live in Second Life today is Agent Paranoia, Ahava, Anastasia Jennings, Cyzerix Core, Legion Rosenman, Roshan Amatersu. Sorry, dude, you got a really difficult name to produce. And WPDK.
And you say I'm bad with names. Well, we got no feedback for today. Do you have anything, or should we just continue on to the news?
I have nothing to say right now.
Okay, so right into the news. In internet privacy news, thanks to Wyandy for this one. The legislation that could kill internet privacy for good. This is really more of an opinion piece here, it's not really written like an article, but it does have some pretty good info, so I'll read it anyway. Every right-thinking person abhors child pornography. To combat it, legislators have brought through committee a poorly conceived, overbroad congressional bill. The Protecting Children from Internet Pornographers Act of 2011. It is arguably the biggest threat to civil liberties now under consideration in the United States. The potential victims, everyone who uses the internet. The good news, it hasn't gone before the full house yet. The bad news, it already has made it through committee, and history shows that in times of moral panic, overly broad legislation has a way of becoming law. In fact, a particular moment comes to mind. And they go on here with a blurb about a much older draconian law. It's an interesting read, but it's a bit long, so I'm going to skip it for the sake of brevity. A better name for the child pornography bill would be the Encouragement of Blackmail by Law Enforcement Act. At issue is how to catch child pornographers. It's too hard now, says the bill's backers, and I can sympathize. That's the article here, not me. It's their solution that appalls me. Under language approved 19-10 by a House committee, the firm sells you internet access would be required to track all of your internet activity and save for 18 months. So what you're saying here is that your ISP would have to track all your activity for 18 months and save it. Or save it for 18 months. Along with your name, the address where you live, your bank account numbers, your credit card numbers, and IP addresses you've been assigned, which they already have that, so whatever. Tracking the private daily behavior of everyone in order to help catch a small number of child criminals is itself the noxious practice of police states, said an attorney for the Electronic Frontier Foundation. The data retention mandate in this bill would treat every internet user like a criminal and threaten the online privacy and free speech of every American. Even more troubling is what the government would need to do in order to access this trove of private information. Ask for it. I kid you not, that's it. So what they're saying here is you don't need a warrant. As written, the Protecting Children from Internet Pornographers Act of 2011 doesn't require that someone be under investigation for child pornography charges in order for the police to access their internet history. Being suspected of any crime is enough. It may even be made available to in civil matters like divorce trials and child custody battles. Nor do police need probable cause to search for this information. As Representative James Sussenbrenner says, I'm not sure what that means in bracket
Republican Wisconsin.
Oh, okay.
Republican Wisconsin.
Okay. It poses numerous risks that will outweigh any benefits, and I'm not convinced it will contribute in a significant way to protecting children. So I'm not too familiar with how your laws work down there, but I think the law hasn't actually passed yet. It's just gone through part of your legislative process.
Bad, 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 all bad. This is bad, 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 bad. You know, I was actually just reading a story just recently about how the UK government is going to essentially be shutting off social networking and other things like that, like the BlackBerry Messenger and Facebook and things like that, whenever there's any type of riots or anything going on, so people apparently can't coordinate. And this is, you know, this is kind of along the same lines here, is because a small number of people are ruining everything for the rest of us, now our government is doing all these really crazy things. You know, I mean, like it says here, you don't need any type of probable cause, you don't need any, you know, anything. It can be for any crime. So they could be doing stuff like this for, like I said, riots. You know, if there's anything like that, they could be just asking the ISPs, okay, we have these people, I want to know exactly who they were talking to and when, so here, give me their whole internet history. I want to see who they were talking to, you know, I want to see their Facebook profiles, I want to see this, I want to see their names, so on and so forth. And this is just all kinds of bad, you know, this is screwing all of us over to try and, you know, stop a few people, and it's not even going to do that well, you know? And this really isn't going to do much of anything. It's, as much as I hate, you know, child pornographers and pedophiles and stuff like that, you know, this isn't going to do much to try and stop them from what they're doing. You know, they've found ways again around pretty much every single thing that we've ever come up with to try and stop these guys, and this isn't going to do it.
My concern here is that, I'm going to go a little bit conspiracy on here, is that this is clearly not for child pornography. Of course, they can get these things passed really easy by saying that, oh, it's to protect the children. But look how broad it is. You don't even need to be accused of child pornography. You can just be suspected of it. And they don't even, it doesn't even need to be child pornography. You can be suspected of anything, and they can go get it. So clearly what they're doing here is they need a broad, or they want a broad law, that they can just gather your information whenever they want it. And they found an easy way to pass it by pinning it on child pornographers.
You know, this is exactly the same as the USA Patriot Act. You know, they say that it's, you know, stop terrorists and so on and so forth. And all that it does is just really screw over all the rest of us, you know. And all the people that are the people that they're trying to target, that's the people who it's screwing over.
So write your congressmen and senators and try to get this one shut down.
Amen.
In spyware on your phone news, thanks to Wyandi. New Android Trojan targets records your phone conversations. There's a new Android Trojan in town, and it's a secret weapon, is the ability to record your phone's conversations. At least that's what CA Technologies' Dinesh Venkatesan said in his latest blog. According to this report, the malware drops a configuration file, one that contains key information about the remote server and its parameters, once installed on the victim's device, and then records and stores phone conversations in AMR format on the consumer's SD card. Based on the configuration file, it is assumed that the Trojan has the ability to upload these conversations through a remote server maintained by the Trojan's author. This news is a step up from last week's report of a Trojan that logged details of incoming and outgoing phone calls, and their duration. Venkatesan said, didn't say how he came across this new malicious package, but explains that he tested the eavesdropper malware in a controlled environment with two mobile emulators running along simulated internet services. One screenshot confirms that the malware must ask permission before installing itself on the device, emulating a legitimate app. Making a phone call from the victim's device to trigger the payload reads one. Making a phone call from the victim's device to trigger the payload reads one screenshot option. And as the conversation goes on, the Trojan stores the recorded call in directory Shangzhou slash call record on the SD card. So this might be from China or something like that, because Shangzhou seems like a Chinese word. The file was saved in 2011.073.101.284.2001.amr. That's a mouthful. And could be played in VLC Media Player. The actual size of the audio file wasn't given. It is already widely acknowledged that this year, the year of the mobile malware, we advise smartphone users to be more logical and exercise basic security principles while surfing the internet and installing any applications. Of course, that's easier said than done when consumers place trust in Google and assumes that the search engine giant is on the ball filtering any disguised malware lurking in the Android market. And while Android has the upper hand over Apple's iOS in terms of development freedom, installing new apps from outside the Android market / Amazon App Store circle is certainly risky business. So why would anyone want to record a stranger's conversation? Simple: account password, social security numbers, any number of personal information that typically exchanged verbally with bill collectors over the phone. But wading through all the other garbage, simple talk, dirty talk, business talk, is another story, and that would take a lot of patience. Of course, your simple conversations can reveal a lot about you as well. You can find out names of people, you can figure out little details of someone's life that you could use to convince them you're someone else, stuff like that.
You know, what I see with this here is that you really need to practice, you know, PerSec. You need to practice OPSEC and PerSec. You gotta, you know, be aware of what you're putting out on the airwaves here with your phones. You know that pretty much every single mode of communication that you have is compromised. You know, unless you have, you know, secure telephone to secure telephone communications like the military does, you know, and the government does, then what you're doing is you're putting, you know, unencrypted communications out there on the, you know, on the web or wherever. And what you need to do is you need to start getting into cryptography and learning and realizing that pretty much everything that you're doing is out there and somebody can read it or and has access to it. So this is just a good time and a good reason to start, you know, practicing stuff like that.
And of course, it says here that you need user input to install it, which a lot of malicious code does, because really it's not malicious code at that point. It's just code that they're tricking the user to installing it that does something the user didn't want to do. So just make sure you're really aware of what you're installing, and if anything you don't recognize as being installed, get the hell off your machine. In Pick Up That Can Citizen News, thanks to Wyandi, and Pick Up That Can's reference to Half-Life 2. Mobile biometrics to hit US streets. We are fast approaching a time when law enforcement will no longer need to ask for your identification. Your physical self and the biometric data therein are all that will be required to identify you. A gadget attached to a mobile phone can photograph and plot key points and features on your face, breaking the numbers down into biometric data, scan your iris, and take your fingerprints on the spot. This gizmo doesn't exist in this futuristic world. It's already being developed and it's already being prototyped and tested. By autumn, the Mobile Offender Recognition and Information System, MORIS, will allow 40 law enforcement agencies across the U.S. to carry out such biometric diagnostics. So far, the 1,000 units on order at $3,000 and 2.5 ounces per unit will be going to sheriff and the police departments. Proponents of this technology figure the deployment is a plus, having biometric data available almost instantaneously might prevent an officer from mistakenly identifying anyone, say, via, say, a driver's license, which could be forged, and unnecessarily hauling them in for processing. Scans taken on the road are checked against a database of stored scans from those who have in the past been currently incarcerated. Essentially, the idea is to see if a suspect has a prior record. It's accurate, it'll keep us safe, yeah, I don't doubt that, and it'll help law enforcement do its job. But given that three of the functions of MORIS could legally be considered to be the sort of search and seizure covered by the U.S. Constitution's Fourth Amendment, meaning that a person could, in theory, decline to have their iris scanned or fingerprints taken, law enforcement's ability to use them as intended seems questionable. The collection of personal biometric data has many privacy and civil liberties concerns attached to it, including scalability, reliability, accuracy, and security of the data collected, said Ami Stepanovich, National Security Council for Electronic Privacy Information Center, EPIC, a Washington, D.C.-based public interest group focused on privacy and civil liberty issues. A key concern, said Stepanovich, said that this technology was essentially developed for a military environment and not for domestic use. The potential for this technology to be used to track and monitor innocent individuals' personal information cannot be overshadowed. To prevent misuse, warrant requirements must be strictly enforced. Which I agree, I mean, this is good technology for identifying people, but we need to make sure it's not just used wantonly to keep track of everyone.
What this technology is actually based off of is there is I can't remember the exact acronym of it, but over in Afghanistan especially, they're using essentially, it looks like an old school digital camera, you know, one of the really old ones that are like enormous, And what they do is it takes all the biometric data that you actually put it up to your eye, and it has like retinal identification software and fingerprint identification and all kinds of other stuff. Like it says here in the article, it was developed for the military environment, and this has been used for the last couple of years. So, you know, this really isn't anything new or exciting. Now, having it being used here in the United States in a domestic, you know, in a domestic environment is extremely different. But this really shouldn't come as any surprise. You know, a lot of this stuff, scarily enough, a lot of the technology and stuff that's been used over in Afghanistan and Iraq is actually coming back here stateside. You know, after a couple of years of being used over there, it ends up here in, you know, local police departments. And, you know, a lot of police department vets are familiar with this stuff because they're you know, veterans of the military. They've done this stuff over in, you know, Iraq and Afghanistan. And so it's no big deal to them, you know. It's just another day.
Yeah, it's a good idea to keep a low profile, especially in this day and age. If you don't need to be identified when doing something, try to avoid being identified when doing something, because every little bit of information that you let out is just another way that someone can track you. And you never know when someone, you know, say in a high position in a police department, decides they don't like you. And I mean, it's happened. There's corruption all over the place. So just make sure you try to keep out of the way of stuff like this and avoid it whenever you can. In Fighting Back news, thanks to Wyandi again. Telex software circumvents internet censorship. A group of students and professors at the University of Michigan have developed Telex, a software that could allow users to break through government-level censorship of websites. According to the researchers, many anti-censorship systems work by making an encrypted connection, called a tunnel, from the user's computer and a trusted proxy server located outside the censor's network. The result is a cat-and-mouse game between the censor and the proxy servers that need to be blocked to enforce censorship. There is virtually no way to generally know the IP address and login information of proxy servers, while the same information path is kept secret from the censoring authority. Telex, on the other hand, creates a proxy server without an IP address. The user simply needs the Telex app to access censored websites. When the user wants to visit a blacklisted site, the client establishes an encrypted HTTPS connection to a non-blacklisted web server outside the censor's network, which could be a normal site that the user regularly visits. Since the connection looks normal, the censor allows it, but this connection is only a decoy. The client request is registered as a Telex request by using a cryptographic tag in the connection headers, and only Telex is able to recognize a tagged connection. The connection travels over the internet en route to the non-blacklisted website. It passes through routers at various ISPs in the core of the network. The technology would require ISPs to deploy devices that hold a private key to decipher the tagged HTTPS connections from Telex clients. The stations would then direct the connections to anti-censorship services such as proxy servers or Tor entry points, which clients can use to access blocked websites. This creates an encrypted tunnel between a Telex user and a Telex station at the ISP, redirecting connections to any site on the internet, the researcher said. The problem with this deployment is that you need the ISP involved.
This would also, you know, be a good way for people to end up, you know, getting around this new legislation that they've been proposing that we featured earlier in this story. So, you know, I mean, this just goes to show that regardless of what you know, limitations you put in, people are going to find a way around it.
Yeah, to those who didn't understand the technical aspects of that, what's basically doing is your computer is connecting to a website that's not censored. And along with that traffic, the computer is also sending along an encrypted stream of data, which when detected by one of the Telex services on the other end, will redirect your traffic to the site you're trying to get to, and basically send along the data you want along this legitimate-looking connection to some innocuous website. In forward-thinking news, thanks to Bob. DARPA to fund hackerspaces. First wave hackerspace member Mudge of Loft Heavy Industries announced that DARPA is creating a new initiative called Cyber Fast Track to fund defense-related projects by small groups of programmers. Have an idea for some black ice you can make for the feds? Apply today. They're claiming a 10-year turnaround on proposals.
a 10-day turnaround on the proposals. Not 10-year, my friend. But, you know, this is a really good trend. I'm finally starting to see, you know, DARPA and the military getting in on this whole crowdsourcing thing, and they're able to make a lot better use of resources this way, is getting hold of, you know, people who know what they're doing outside of the standard military-industrial complex, you know, moving into, you know, private hacker spaces, stuff like that, you know, private citizens. And I see this happening a lot more, is they're actually starting to rely on these guys to make some of the new cutting-edge technologies. And I think it's really good that we're starting to move away from, you know, the, you know, crazy defense contractors making everything, you know, Motorola, Lockheed Martin, so on and so forth. You know, those guys making all this stuff. We're moving this our technology forward in using innovative ideas from outside the normal sphere of influence for military applications. I think this is a really good trend.
I also think it's a fairly good trend, but we do need to keep an eye on this to make sure that, because DARPA is getting something out of this. They're getting some research out of this. But we need to make sure they don't try to go out of their way and control the rest of the hackerspaces, because, like, just turning the hackerspaces into one of their projects would not be a good thing. But it definitely is good to see some government money being put into some place where it can do some good, and they can get some real research out of it, instead of having a bunch of guys sit around, the same people thinking up the same things over and over again. In conspiracy news, thanks to Fat Ninja. Man, we're going through the stories fast today. Crash kills members of SEAL Team 6. U.S. officials tell the Associated Press that they believe none of the U.S. Navy SEALs who died in a helicopter crash in Afghanistan have participated in the raid on the that killed Osama bin Laden, although they were from the same unit that carried out the bin Laden mission. Sources say that more than 20 Navy SEALs were among those lost in the crash in Afghanistan. Operators from SEAL Team 6 were flown by a regular Army crew, that's according to AP military sources. Another source is the team was thought to include 22 SEALs, 3 Air Force controllers, 7 Afghan Army troops, a dog and his handler, and a civilian interpreter, plus the helicopter crew. The sources thought this was the largest single loss of life ever for SEAL Team 6, known as the Naval Special Warfare Development Group. All sources spoke on condition of anonymity to discuss sensitive military matters. So basically, a helicopter went down and killed like 22 SEAL Team 6 members, or SEAL members, and at least some of them were SEAL Team 6. And they're claiming this that they weren't involved with the Osama bin Laden thing, but I guarantee you're not going to find out who was involved with the Osama bin Laden thing versus who was in this helicopter.
Essentially what happened here with this helicopter crash is, because this article is a couple of days old, is what happened is they were flying in a kind of like a quick reaction force type of idea, and they were on station in a CH-47 Chinook, which is the largest and fastest helicopter that the military operates. And essentially what had happened is there were Rangers on the ground that got into a firefight, and they were requesting support. So the SEALs just happened to be the guys that had picked up the quick reaction force duty for that day. And they kind of, you know, rotated off between units. And, you know, if anybody needs support, these guys were on call, and they'd, you know, rush to the helicopter, hop in, and, you know, go back them up. And essentially that's what it was, is these SEALs were the unit that was supposed to be doing this. And they were coming in for a landing. From what I heard, in the CH-47, they actually got hit by an RPG. And the time that a helicopter is most vulnerable is whenever it's taking off and landing. So, you know, that's when it's the slowest, that's when it's the lowest to the ground, when it's the easiest to hit. So, you know, it's really a shame what happened here. But, you know, this is an enormous loss to the SEAL and the Special Forces community there. I mean, 22 guys, that's a lot of people. You know, that's a whole team just gone. You know, not like a team like SEAL Team 6 or whatever it is. Now what actually happens is SEAL Team 6 does not exist any longer. They were originally one of the original SEAL teams, and they actually got turned into the Naval Special Warfare Development Group, or DEVGRU for short. And that was just essentially, they turned into a different type of unit, going from a regular, you know, counter-terror SEAL team to essentially they were the R&D portion for the, you know, Naval Special Warfare. And they, you know, they also did, you know, they were some of the high-end operators in the SEAL teams, and they were kind of poached from all the other teams to make one uber team that knew exactly what they were doing. And it's a real loss to have these guys, because this is really bad, you know?
Oh yeah, sad to see those guys go. I mean, I'd like to see more special forces warfare over there instead of having just the ground troops doing this bombing the shit out of everything. But, you know, something to look at. You know, if you're more conspiracy-minded, people might freak out about this because SEAL Team 6 or DevGru was involved in the Osama bin Laden thing, so, you know, there might be some speculation about that. But moving on into DNA database news. Don't need to worry about conspiracy this, because this is right here. Thanks to Destin. California appeals court strikes. California appeals courts strike down law requiring DNA sample from arrestees. The three-judge panel for the California First District Court of Appeals ruled unanimously on Thursday that DNA samples cannot be taken broadly from any adult or arrested or charged with a felony, striking down the 2004 voter-enacted provision of the DNA and Forensic and Identification Database and Data Bank Act of 1998. It's a lot of words there. The court ruled that such mandates violate Fourth Amendment provisions against unreasonable search and seizure and overturned the lower court's ruling for the state. The law made it a misdemeanor for felons to refuse the DNA sample from the law's DNA data bank. The law argued that state DNA samples were akin to fingerprints, and therefore is a misdemeanor, and thus should be collected in the same manner. Justice Anthony Klein, writing for the unanimous court, disagreed. Even focusing on DNA profile alone, the analogy to fingerprints is blind to the nature of DNA. Courts are well aware that recent studies have begun to question the notion that even focusing on the DNA profile alone. Okay, I just need to take a moment here and fix this article. Okay, recent studies have begun to question that the notion that junk DNA does not contain useful genetic programming material, and an intense debate on this subject is now taking place in the scientific and legal communities, like the DNA laws of almost every other state and federal law. The DNA Act is silent on how long these specimens and samples may be kept, and it is reasonable to expect that they will be preserved long into the future. When it may be possible to extract even more personal and private information than as now is the case, the Act places few restrictions on the law enforcement uses which such information may be put. This is kind of badly written. This raises questions about the kind of personal and private information that may be derived from DNA samples in the DOJ's possession, Department of Justice. The uses of that biometric data as scientific developments increase the type of... Okay, it goes on a lot more about that here. But at the end here, it basically says that they can go to the California Supreme Court and get this overturned again. So right now, we got a little bit of a win here, saying that people who aren't actually convicted of a crime don't have to submit their DNA. And they're saying here that they might appeal that and try to get that law back.
I really don't have too terribly much of a problem with, you know, convicted felons having their DNA taken and stored and, you know, put into CODIS, because, you know, that's kind of the whole point of it. And I really don't have a problem with that, because it actually has solved a lot of unsolved crimes. What I do have an issue with is if you are suspected of a felony, and or you aren't a felon, you know, and you've just committed a misdemeanor and you have to go to jail for whatever, or, you know... Regardless if you have to go to jail or not, even if you're convicted of the misdemeanor, your, you know, DNA ends up in this stupid database. I think that's wrong. You know, I think that it should only be for convicted felons only, I think is what it should be. You know, and yes, it would solve some crimes because, you know, no matter how big your data sample is, if you get an enormous data sample, you know, a portion of those that are going to be misdemeanors are going to be hits on felonies. And it would solve those crimes. But, you know, the way we have to take a look at this is we need to look at the broad picture instead of, you know, solving two crimes. You know, and yeah, it really sucks for those families and everything that they won't get solved. And it would really suck if, you know, I was one of those families or something like that. But, you know, you got to look at it as a whole countrywide and, you know, in fact, international, you know, decision is what it is. And things that happen in the United States do affect other countries, you know, quite readily, you know, within the UK and Canada and the European Union and stuff like that. A lot of them tend to look at the US for some rulings on things like this.
Well, you gotta remember about this is that they're kind of pulling the angle of, what do you have to hide? It's just your DNA. If you didn't do anything wrong, blah, 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 blah. Well, you gotta keep in mind that your DNA says a lot about you that you don't even know, sort of thing. So let's look at, say, if they find some genes that make you a little more predisposed to violence, then how often are you going to be investigated for crimes you have nothing to do with just because your DNA profile matches what this kind of person would do? Or let's say you're predisposed to some kind of diseases or whatever, and insurance companies get their hands on this data, then they can go through and go, well, you're predisposed to leukemia, so we're not going to give you life insurance or health insurance because you're likely to get this. So you break your leg, you go to the hospital, and you have no insurance, and it costs you a lot of money because of the fact that they got your DNA profile. So DNA profile should be one of those things. I agree that criminals should have their DNA taken because that way if they commit crimes again, you can trace it back to them. But if you're in the middle of an investigation and you're found to no longer be suspected or found to be not guilty, if they took any DNA from you, that should be destroyed immediately. It should not go into any databases, should not be sequenced, should not anything. That should be thrown out. And if you aren't being charged with a serious crime, or you don't even have, they don't have proper evidence, then they should just not even take. Someone's posting here, "Ouch, Hugo, that's harsh. No limits on what kind of crimes." Well, I would say serious crimes, rape, murder, you know, stuff like that. If you steal a purse, it shouldn't be a DNA kind of offense there. So, yeah, don't worry. I'm not this crazy, right wing throw anyone in jail kind of guy. But I'm talking criminals here, not just little petty purse thieves and shit.
You know, real criminals, people that are hurting people, you know, not like you said, you know, not the guy that's arrested for, you know, pot possession or whatever, you know, like rapists, murderers, people like that.
Okay, we're getting through the show really fast here. I might throw another couple stories in at the end here just to fill up some more time. In shit
well, I have
news.
I have some Cyberpunk Kid if you want me to throw it in there.
Okay, whatever. And shitty mood news, thanks to Nicotine for this one. That anxiety may be in your gut, not in your head. McMaster Research finds link between gut bacteria and behavior. For the first time, researchers at McMaster University have conclusive evidence that bacteria residing in the gut influence brain chemistry and behavior. The findings are important because several common types of gastrointestinal disease, including irritable bowel syndrome, are frequently associated with anxiety or depression. In addition, there has been speculation that some psychiatric disorders, such as late-onset autism, may be associated with abnormal bacteria content in the gut. The exciting results provide stimulus for further research into microbial component to the causation of behavioral illnesses, says Stephen Collins, Professor of Medicine and Associate Dean Research, Michael G. DeGroote, School of Medicine. Collins and Primisil Burkick, Assistant Professor of Medicine, took the research to the Foncombe Family Digestive Health Research Institute. The research appears in the online expedition of the journal Gastroenterology. Wow, there's a journal specifically for that? That's interesting. For each person, the gut is about to home to 1,000 trillion bacteria, which we all live in harmony. The bacteria perform a number of functions vital to health. They harvest energy from the diet, protect against infections, and provide nutrition to cells in the gut. Any disruption can result in life-threatening conditions, such as antibiotic-induced colitis, from infection of the superbug called Clostridium difficile. Working with healthy adult mice, the researchers have showed that disrupting the normal bacterial content of the gut with antibiotics produced changes in behavior. The mice became less cautious or anxious. The change was accompanied by an increase in brain-derived neurotrophic factor, BDNF, which has been linked to depression and anxiety. And they have a little bit of study here. It says when oral antibiotics are discontinued, the bacteria in the gut return to normal.
Well, you know, this is just another reason to try and avoid pharmaceuticals, you know, whenever possible. And it just goes to show that, you know, the body really is one big giant machine, that, you know, what you put into your body really does affect who you are and what's going on in your brain. and it affects the way that you act, you know. And this is why, you know, you see people that are eating shit food, you know, guilty as charged, end up trying, you know, sometimes have, you know, especially after a couple of years, end up with some weird issues, you know. And this is why, you know, in lower class areas and stuff, that might account for some of the behavior that we see is, you know, people having shitty diet and that affecting their brain. And it really goes to show, like I said, that the body is one big giant machine, and what you put in does change that.
Oh yeah, definitely. Everything that we put in their body is going to have, if it has an effect, it's going to have side effects. It's pretty much just something we know about anything that has any kind of effect in your body. So this is just another side effect we found out, that of course antibiotics kill bacteria, but they don't discern which bacteria they kill, and that's causing a lot of secondary effects here. So definitely, this, you need to be aware, take as little drugs as possible, only take them when you really need them, and like, we just need to get rid of this whole drug society that we've kind of created around this. In Mars news, thanks to nicotine. NASA spacecraft data suggests water flowing on Mars. Pasadena, California. Observations from NASA's Mars Reconnaissance Orbiter have revealed possible flowing water during the warmest months on Mars. Of course, we've known about water on Mars for a while, just we never thought it was in a liquid form. NASA's Mars exploration program keeps bringing us closer to determining whether the red planet could harbor life in some form, NASA Administrator Charles Bolden said. It reaffirms that Mars is an important future destination for human exploration. Dark finger-like structures appear to and extend down some of the Martian slopes during late spring through summer, fade in winter, and return during next spring. Repeated observations have tracked seasonal changes in these recurring features on several steep slopes in the middle latitudes on Mars' southern hemisphere. The best explanation for these observations so far is a flow of briny water, said Alfred McEwen of the University of Arizona in Tucson. McEwen is the principal investigator for the Orbiter's High Resolution Imaging Science Experiment, HIRISE, and lead author of a report about the recurring flows published on Thursday's edition of the Journal of Science. They dropped the word there. Some aspects of the observations still puzzle researchers, but flows of liquid brine fit the features characteristics better than alternative hypothesis. Saltiness lowers the freezing temperature of water. Sites with active water flows get warm enough, even in shallow subsurface, to sustain liquid water as about as salty as the Earth's oceans, while pure water would freeze at the observed temperatures. These dark lineations are different from other types of features on Martian slopes, said Mars Reconnaissance Orbiter Project scientist Richard Zurek of NASA's Jet Propulsion Laboratory in Pasadena. Repeated observations show that they extend ever farther downhill with time during the warm season. The features imaged are only about 0.5 to 5 yards or meters wide, with lengths of up to hundreds of yards. The width is much narrower than previously reported gullies on the Martian slopes. However, some of these locations display more than 1,000 individual flows. While gullies are abundant on cold, pole-facing slopes, these dark flows are on warmer, equator-facing slopes. The images show flows lengthen and darken on rocky, equator-facing slopes from late spring to early fall. The seasonality, latitude distribution, and brightness changes suggest a volatile material is involved, but there is no direct detection of one. The settings are too warm for carbon dioxide frost, and at some sites, too cold for pure water. This suggests that the action of brines, which have lower freezing points, salt deposits over much of Mars indicate brines were abundant in Mars' past. These recent observations suggest that brines may still form near the surface today in limited times and places.
Really is, you know, groundbreaking research here is that if there actually is water on Mars, it could really mean a lot for, you know, future human habitation. If not only, you know, just research stations on Mars. But I think that, unfortunately, a lot of what's said in this article is a lot of conjecture. I mean, it's a lot of evidence based on photographs, which, you know, are very difficult to determine. I think what we need to do is, yeah, let's go check this out. Hey, let's go to Mars, guys. Let's go get some people, you know, boots on the ground, checking it out. You know, let's go to some of these gullies in, you know, the spring, and let's go check this shit out. That's my opinion.
Oh yeah, well, if this is just salty water up there on Mars, that's pretty good for us, because it's pretty easy for us to remove salt from water at this point in time. So if they had flowing water on Mars, that makes it really easy for us to set up a colony there, as water would be one of our main priorities in getting any kind of growth going, because the soil is definitely rich enough to grow plants, but we need to make sure we have liquid water to do it. In What the Fuck News, thanks to Nicotine for this one. Kidnappers introduce victim's girlfriend to wife. Police are investigating a bizarre robbery and kidnapping that happened in Miami-Dade County on Tuesday night. Police said it all started just after 11 p.m., in which four men in ski masks ambushed a couple sitting in a pickup truck at 98 East 43rd Street in Hialeah. The robbers forced the man into a waiting vehicle, and two of the robbers got into the pickup truck with the woman, Miami police said. The masked police used flex cuffs to bind the man's and woman's wrists and drove them to the man's house on Northwest 14th Street in Miami, according to investigators. When they arrived at the house, police said they had found the man's wife, his mother, and two children in the home. Police said the robbers tied up the whole family, beat the man, roughed up his wife, took jewelry and money from the home, and the men took up $1,000 in cash and jewelry, Miami police said. But before leaving, the robbers brought the man's girlfriend into the home and introduced her to his wife, according to investigators. The robbers then left them all together in the house and took off. Miami police said the robbers were in their mid-20s to early 30s. Police have recovered the victim's vehicle. So, they must have really pissed someone off, and apparently the guy had a mistress, I guess?
You know, and this just goes to show, you know, I find it very amusing that these guys would go out of their way to introduce the girlfriend to the wife there. And, you know, it shows that these guys were casing him for a while. You know, they knew his house. You know, they brought in his girlfriend that he knew he was going to be with. You know, they followed him. Stuff like that. You know, it just goes to show, if you're going to be doing stuff, keep your head on a swivel, you know? Act like you're always being followed. Check your rearview mirrors as you're driving down the street. I've actually been followed a couple of times, and, you know, I've ended up quite close to my house whenever it happened, and I was able to luckily avoid them because I kind of had, you know, somewhat of a plan to kind of avoid these guys. But, you know, keep your head on a swivel. Watch out, you know? This stuff happens to random people. You know, it could be anybody. You know, it could be you, it could be me. It could be, you know, the crazy guy that has a wife and a mistress in Miami. So, just, you know, watch your heads. Watch your asses, boys.
One tip, if you're being followed ever, and you have this chance, try not to go home. Try to go someplace else that's, like, really heavily populated and you can get help right away. Because leading them home, they might just come back later and deal with you when you're not so alert of their whereabouts.
Another thing can do is if you do see somebody following you, start making weird turns. You know, if you're on the highway and you think someone's following, you know, they've been following you for a while, you know, cut the exit real quick. You know, don't use a blinker or anything, and cut under the, you know, the zebra striping on the side there. You know, cut into that and get off real quick, see how they react. You know, you know, blow through red light. One tried and true tactic that a lot of bodyguards use and stuff is to blow through a red light, you know, is maybe slow down a tiny bit, but just totally blow through it. And if you're being followed, they'll follow you right through the red light. If you're not, they're going to stop. And, you know, if they think that they've been blown because of it, they're going to stop there as well. So, you know, either way, you've lost them. But what happened to me is I was driving down the street and some guy started following me, and I was right by my house whenever he started following me. And I was actually on my street whenever it happened, and I ended up turning into an adjacent complex, like, of condos. And I actually ended up losing him through there, going like 40 at like 2 in the morning through this complex and making a lot of turns and stuff. You know, it just shows you it pays to be situationally aware.
Yeah, if you're lucky enough to be followed while you're in a vehicle, then you have a major advantage, because you can just keep going to the nearest police station and phone them up. Just say, like, look, I'm being followed. I'm going to stop at this police station. Could you send an officer out? Don't exit the car until you actually have an officer there. But if you're on foot, like I usually am, the way I do it is, if I think I'm being followed, I cross the street. And if they cross with me, I cross back. If they cross again, you know you're being followed. And then I take measures to lose them. Anyway, on to our next story here. We have a bit of a what the fuck story again. Cartoonist is targeted with criminal probe for mocking police. And this, I believe, is thanks to the Nicotine. The Renton County prosecutor wants to send a cartoonist to jail for mocking the police department in a series of animated internet videos. The South Park-style animations parody everything from officers having sex on duty to certain personnel getting promoted without necessary qualifications. While the city wants to criminalize the cartoons, First Amendment rights advocates say the move is an extreme abuse of power. Only Kuro Team 7 investigative reporter Chris Halsney took a key document that really lays bare the city's intent. The document was quietly filed in King County Supreme Court last week. It's a search warrant accusing an anonymous cartoon creator going by the name of Mr. Fiddlesticks of cyberstalking the Renton Police Department and a local prosecutor got a judge to sign off as a way to uncover the name of whoever's behind the parodies. Halsney talked to three nationally respected legal experts who believe the use of cyberstalking statute is likely stopping on the Constitution. The series of web-based short cartoons featured a mustachioed street cop and short-haired female bureaucrat. The dry and at times witty banter between the two touches on some of the embarrassing insider secrets, some of which in the matchup with internal affairs on file with Renton PD. So this isn't a very good cartoon, it's just something that someone slapped together with some free web tool, and it's a little funny. I watched some of it, but I couldn't really get through it. But it seems that the police are pissed off about this, because this lines up pretty well with some stuff that's actually been happening in their department.
You know, this is just, essentially what this is probably some internal affairs guy, or, you know, somebody who has access to some of these records, you know, making fun of the department. And you know what, I think they should have a thicker skin about it. You know, if they really are divulging, you know, confidential information, then yeah, it might be a little bit of an issue, but it's not, you know, not horrible. And this is just, you know, this is just ridiculous. Grow a thicker skin. You know, you're cops, you know? Just learn to deal with it. You know, shut up your public servants. Just deal with it.
Yeah, it's more upset here. What if it's just a coincidence? Now, of course, in the story, it did say that he never did indicate what city or what the name of the police department was or any real names. So there's nothing that, like, me, if me and Edmonton found this cartoon without reading the story first, I wouldn't have any reason to suspect that it's actually real, or that this police department was involved, or any of these cops were involved. So really, by going and going after this guy, they've basically just pointed everyone to say, hey, look, this cartoon's about us.
Yeah, you know, that's just kind of like putting a big red flag on your head and making yourselves look like a bunch of fools. But moving on to Recomedia, we have March of the Bonus Army, thanks to Jules Verboven. In 19... Where did I cut off there?
You cut off right at the beginning. You just said like two words, so just start over.
Okay, and now moving on to our Recomedia, we have March of the Bonus Army, thanks to Jules Verboven. In 1932, an army of World War I veterans march on Washington, D.C. to get paid out of their bonds promised during World War I. And in Cyberpunk Kit, we have Daredevil, as in the comic hero glasses, thanks to Cykros, who's actually here in the show tonight, and a new device that links spy glasses, a webcam, and a smartphone could make it easier for blind people to see shapes by converting visual signals to auditory ones and sending them to another part of the brain. And another little cool piece of Cyberpunk Kit that I found today is a better helmet for the military that helps protect against traumatic brain injury. Eclipse Performance Gear has turned some heads with its helmet innovation. First up is the helmet attachment platform. It's essentially, it has a whole bunch of cool stuff that you can attach to the helmet. And then it also includes a sensor inside the top of the helmet and top of the crown where it actually senses the shock. So if there's any type of, you know, IED detonation or something like that, it can be accurately measured by this device placed in the crown of the helmet, and it's used to help treat traumatic brain injury. And the daily hack for today is a whole bunch of info on DIY gun-related projects, thanks to Jules Verboven. And this is a huge collection of articles about home gunsmithing for educational purposes only, of course. Consult local law enforcement before messing with any of this stuff. There are too many things to list here, so hit up the topic for today's show in the Rant forums and for all the links to all of this.
Don't worry, we'll be back next week to make sure you can get the news you need to survive. If you cannot contribute to the show, please distribute it. We would like to thank the Army of Flying Monkeys for their assistance in gathering data. If you have any news stories or pertinent information you want to send us, you can reach us at news@rostudios.org. That's news@rostudios.org. If you like the music in the background, check out the album Optics by iScintilla. We fade out now with a track by Patient Zero, which is quite popular on YouTube right now. He took a little clip from a Minecraft podcast called Yogscast and remixed it into kind of an awesome song here. It's called Dwarf Hole, Diggy Diggy Hole. Remember, everyone, we'll not defeat the enemy if we are at each other's throats. So until next time, that's what Server said. End of line.
I feel like we need a song to sing whilst digging. Do you have any ideas? It needs to be something funny and sort of lighthearted, doesn't it?
I'm a dwarf and I'm digging a hole. Diggy, diggy hole, I'm digging a hole. I'm a dwarf and I'm digging a hole. Diggy, diggy hole, I'm digging a hole.
Diggy, diggy hole!